Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, the Maine Audio Information and Reading Service, a program of the IRIS Network, serving Maine's blind and visually impaired. My name is Cynthia Bowman, and I'm reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. During our last episode, number 10 for this book, we were at sea the entire time. Life on board, with a healthy male captain, can be a bit trying sometimes for our diarist, but she is full of spunk and remains enamored of her handsome captain. They are only opposites in some ways. They share a love of the sea and a desire to see the world. Those are a couple of pretty big shared interests. We've read about 2/3 of this diary, have arrived in January 1912, with another year to experience. We'll continue reading now. January 25th, 1912, 3727 West Longitude, 009 North Latitude, little headway. Ironed, of course, embroidered and mended, of course. Then came the deluge. We had just gone to bed around midnight when there came quite a white squall. I thought this craft would sink. Immediately I remembered, in my panic, that I had questioned Fred about carrying no ballast, and his telling me that the southern seas this time of the year were kind. Well, we nearly turned turtle. Fred dashed madly on deck in nothing but what God gave him as a birthday suit. Dawson's mate, Smith, was at the wheel. If Dawson had been on watch, it might not have happened, as he has an eye for squalls. But neither Smith nor the mate saw the monster coming, as they should have. The mate was all confused and shouted to let the topsails down. That was like feeding a whisper to a gale. Fred acted magnificently. He let go the spanker sheet to cut down the force of the wind upon us. Then he let go the spanker topsail. It started to rain torrents. The wind moderated. But this vessel rode along on her port side, the port rail under water, too long for comfort. If Fred had not relieved her, the ship would have surely tossed her sails into the water and, wetting them, would have turned over. Later, Fred told the mate not to let a squall strike him like that again, so suddenly and so unpreparedly. "If you let that happen again, I'll throw you overboard," he said. If Fred did throw him overboard, no one would ever know what happened to him in that dark pandemonium. Such is life at sea, and I suppose the mate will not be around next trip. Then Fred told me always to remember that he never said any such thing. Landsmen wouldn't understand, he said. Maybe Fred wasn't all wrong in talking of buying a farm. Maybe I shall soon have all the going to sea I want. Maybe, but I doubt it. I'll just watch out for white squalls and be a bit more insistent about ballast. The sea may be nice, but it can also be treacherous, like a smooth-talking sailor, enticing. January 29th, 1912, 45 West Longitude, 317 North Latitude. Ice all gone, cabbage all gone, one duck left. Hope to make Barbados a week today. Reading Newcomb's, picked up in Rio from some English friends. Letters to Mother B, Sister Nettie, Betty, and Mama. Fought with Fred, of course. Won, of course. But expect round two when we go to bed. Wish he would take up smoking or even drinking in moderation. As he is, he's impossible. He needs a bit of weakening. Some say tobacco will do it. I shall get him some, but it'll probably be the wrong kind. Even if he likes it, the most he'll say in praise will be, "It ain't bad." That's down east for wonderfully good. February 1st, 1912, within 300 miles of Barbados. Full moon tomorrow, and that usually means 2 or 3 days of calm. Wish we might make Bridgetown and take our full moon calm there. Dawsey taught me more sea lore about squalls. Come to rain afore to win, take in sail and keep her in. Come to win afore to rain, man can put her out again. Played checkers with Fred. His mind was on fish, so I defeated him twice. Then he got his vengeance by telling me, while washing, that I used too much soap. I said we weren't all that poor. He said that if we had anything, it wasn't from wasting things like soap. One trick for the New England mentality. I said I'd prefer to live in luxury. He said I should have been born rich instead of handsome. A second trick to Fred. February 11th, 1912, Barbados. Some time since I have written here. It's a bother to write. Reached Barbados Saturday morning after being 30 days out from Rio. Took a pilot at the coast at the cost of £1.05. 'Tis a picturesque little island, but cannot equal the magnificence of Rio. Very, very English, slow and quaint and rigidly mannered. Suppose you have to search to extremes for any spontaneity, perhaps in the negro quarter or the midnight parties of the drunken rich who can afford to kick over the traces now and then. The elements we've run into, so far, ship chandlers and officials, all of the middle class, seem to be half asleep and parroting primers of rightful convention. The businessmen, eager to get commissions for arranging our business, came out in bumboats. One, a Mr. Foster, outwitted his peers and took us ashore. Went to American consulate and got mail forwarded from Rio. Photo of pretty sister Myra and cards from Captain J.W. One card told Fred he was lucky to have me and ordered him to treat me well. Father B. is chartered with coal from Baltimore to Fort-de-France, Martinique, at $2 a ton. Freights are up this year. The consul is a Mr. Martin, who was formerly at Martinique. They're Michigan people and very kindly. We discovered that his Martin ancestors were related to mine on my mother's side. Isn't it curious how all my people are kind and bright and good? I says to Fred, while yours are sour. Says Fred, all you Midwesterners get on Uncle Sam's payroll, consuls and teachers, and get free land, so why shouldn't you be carefree and happy? It's us Easterners who pay your way by working hard. We don't have time to be sweet and kind, none, that is, except me. I could have slammed him with a large bunch of newspapers which came in our mail. Mr. Martin's office is at his home, which has beautiful grounds, the garden walks paved with coral. Fred says it's owned by our government, which he supports, so we should feel at home. The shops close at 2 p.m., so had to rush to spend some money, much to Fred's outward consternation, but secret delight. Drove out in a fringed Victoria to the Fosters for dinner and the evening. Such succulent English roast mutton. Saw a polo match on the old military training ground. Mr. F.'s home is one of the old garrison buildings made over. No troops stationed here now since the Spanish have ceased, for 200 years, in trying to take Barbados back. Fred fidgeted all evening, because just as we left the Hopkins, he heard his fish line run out over the stern. He let out a yell as though he was going to dive overboard and grapple with the fish. At dinner he kept looking back at where the Hopkins is moored in the stream, apparently anxious to get back before the fish liberated itself. He didn't know whether he was eating delicious roast mutton or salt mackerel. Fish are the only things that get any enthusiasm out of that herring-gut man. But, still, how he did eat! On Sunday we hired a cab and went out to Crane's Hotel, on the white beach where the sand is as soft as Indian meal. A one-horse cab it was, with a high seat for the coachman, and the gent was in livery. past beautiful, fertile plantations spotted here and there with an old Dutch windmill for irrigation. The winding road, lined with flamboyance of red, cut through the gentle hills which showed small white star flowers in their green. Had breakfast at 10 and lunch at 2 after a swim in the breakers, and got back on board early. Such typically English faces and dress on the people, even the blacks seem more English than the Londoners. Drove home along the coast, past Christchurch. There seems to be a Christchurch in every English colony. I have read of one as far away as New Zealand. The farther away the English get from England, the more English they become. Shopped on Monday and found such good things to eat. Our main boom is being repaired but won't be ready until Tuesday, so we get a chance for more sightseeing. Spent the day on shore. Visited the consuls to clear the ship. Bought a pie-crust mahogany table for my prospected home at Port Clyde. Sailed out into the calm and blue and beautiful Caribbean on Tuesday in the afternoon, and entered Martinique Harbor for a look-see on the Margaret Thomas and Father B. Just like a vagabonding yachting party sailing among the islands, no sign of the Margaret Thomas. Sailed this fairyland and sea of the Caribbean until Saturday night, and then passed out into the Atlantic by Sail Rock. Rough. Heavy seas slamming into us. They have no islands to prevent them from increasing in force out here. Back in the lee of the Leeward Islands, it was like a mill pond. Out here, it is like being in a water wheel. February 15, 1912. All at sea. 25-30 north latitude, 71-40 west longitude, and bound for Jacksonville to load railroad ties for Boston. Still 600 miles to go to Jacksonville. Two very bad storms today. Old mainsail blew to shreds. Spanker tied up, what with too much wind for it to handle. Lost two jibs to Neptune. They blew away before we could get them in. Spent part of the storms reading Wee MacGregor, a typically English book from Barbados, but one long laugh. I shall send it to Myra, who will enjoy it. Thank God for the laughs during the gale. But after the wind went down, up came the devil in Fred. Every time he gets out to sea, after the concentration he must exert in port on ship's business, and after the delight he gets from shoving landsmen around to suit his needs, he starts in on me. When I refuse to play the part of sea-going concubine and assert my rights as an individual who refuses to jump at his least whim, he dredges up the mud, which he knows I despise, and does his damnedest to get my goat. Now it's the baby, which he knows I want so much. He talked of an abortion in Jacksonville. That would make it 2 in 1 year. Not on your tintype. What a horror that would be. He needs a child to soften his hard heart and to give him something else to talk about beyond fish. Isn't it strange that he shies away from the intelligent guests I have on board? A poetess in Rio, Roxy Shaw, the opera singer, and feels at home only with the harlots and whores, such as Captain Rodin brought along with him. Fred says no. He says whores and sailors go together naturally, like codfish with pork scraps. He likes to tell of scores of sailors who married whores and found they made the best of wives. I can understand that the girls might like a change from too much changing, but what I don't like is his harping on it. I told him that I was beginning to understand his great liberalism and his bohemianism. With a look of wonder, he asked me what that was. I told him I might change my antipathy to divorce. Who in hell is Auntie Pathy? Never heard of her, he says. So long as he is prone to being confused like that, I can maintain the upper hand. But I mustn't laugh at him. Last night I was having a good sleep and enjoying being cradled by the jet of the ship and being sung to by the sweep of the wake just outside my bunk, when enters my goatish hubby, hell-bent on what he calls a connection that will make you happy. I told him I was quite content with things as they were, and rolled over away from him. That did it. He started talking about having Nellie Atkinson on board in Boston. I know he wouldn't dare, but he had to say something out of spite. So I returned the volley by telling him he was a little boy who sulked and threatened, and that I'd tell his daddy. His daddy, I said, didn't want him to play with bad girls. I knew, because his daddy had written on one of the postcards that he thought I was a brilliant catch for Fred. All that persiflage unlimbered my stallion, and he went on deck to watch his fish lines. But I could not sleep. I know that he once got Nellie in trouble and paid the malpractitioner. He has tripped over his lines many times in telling me of her when he was trying to get me feeling sexy. If he'd be a bit tender and loving, less abrupt, he might get somewhere. The brute doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell with me, so long as he barges in and thinks with his trousers instead of his head. Imagine asking me to invite Betty for a trip. Imagine his look of awe when I said, "Ay, que bueno, por supuesto, yo me voy, que goza del viaje con ella." Pardon my accent. "Oh, what a beautiful sea. Of course I'll go ashore, and you can enjoy the trip with her." He didn't understand a word, but he got the drift of the ridicule and shut up, puzzled. Then I told him that for one so anxious to make babies, he was a bit off base to have them killed. That stunned him. I pity the pipsqueak wives of Down East sea captains who let themselves get worn out at sea and get sent ashore years later as cast-offs. I shall not join that sorority, and in the end Fred will be proud and glad that I maintained my standards. But it can be hellish, meanwhile, and lots of fun as well. Don't give up the ship, Dora. Sunday, February 18th, 1912, 73 West Longitude, 28 North Latitude, strong southwest wind. Passed a government collier bound for the Panama Canal to increase the stockpile for bunkering the fleet with precious coal, so that the navy Roosevelt built can show the world that America's the gem of the ocean. Or is it Columbia? Fred is in sublime paradise, having caught two dolphins. I caught the steward, preparing pork scraps and threw them overboard. Told him I'd buy him a beer in Jacksonville. Friday, February 23rd, 1912. Still at sea. Headwinds and heavy seas. Passed an American dreadnought and signaled to be reported. Calmer later, but winds headed us offshore. In the evening a slight southwest breeze allowed us to resume our course. Slow work ironing with only one iron. The other leapt overboard out of the cauldron when the steward was trying to bring it aft from the galley stove. Embroidered a sofa pillow for Father B., whom I am falling in love with because he appreciates me, sight unseen. Must be a remarkable man, a real go-getter. At age 12, he went to sea as ship's boy on a mackerel seining two-master, which chased the fish from Hatteras to Newfoundland. Come the following December, when he was shanghaied back to school by his mother, in cahoots with the skipper, young Will came home one day to find 5 new, shiny, $10 bills stretched out on his bed. His mother told me, later, that it helped the family get over March Hill. It was his share in the summer's gross take of fish. From that to being captain of a two-master, the Van Buren, of the Hupper fleet, such a successful driver that he could make 2 ships to 1 made by Captains Sid or Joel Hupper. He was chosen by the daughter of the owner, Mother Bee, to carry on as her husband. The drive and push of past generations was getting worn out and needed fresh blood. Fred is the overwhelming result, and disgustingly so. February 24th, 1912. 90 miles to Jacksonville and in the middle of the Gulf Stream. Good morning sights, but rainy and typically Gulf Stream weather now. However, it's more pleasant than Jayville, to which I do not look forward one iota. I'll read until we set sail for Boston. February 25th, 1912. Tugboat and pilot alongside to take us in from the whistling buoy, off which we anchored last night after breezing in through a thick fog, and past an anchored steamer, something only Fred or his father would have the nerve to do. The ship's bell was struck at minute intervals all night while we lay at anchor, and its lovely toll made me sleep profoundly. This ship is mine. The quarantine doctor has just been aboard. He says we're the cleanest ship he has seen in many moons. No fumigation or quarantine necessary. Hip, hip, hurrah! But there is Ali Baba and the 40 thieves to confront. Or customs. February 28th, 1912. Breeze through customs with my diamond ring on my finger, diamonds turned under. None of the 40 thieves noticed it, too busy looking for dutiable booze. Stupid pilot took us to the wrong loading dock Sunday night, so we had to shift ship Monday bright and early. Now we're at Evans Dock, and ashore I did go, to church Sunday evening, where the place held together, while I prayed for patience with my Fred and strength to rebel against any decree he might attempt concerning our child. My inherited congregational blood steamed mightily as I resolved not to submit to irrational things like Baptist prudishness and Fred's anti-intellectualism. Felt a beautiful catharsis come over with me with my resolve, and the beautiful music of the choir and lovely organ reinforced my determination to be myself. It was significant to me that the ladies in the congregation wore no hats. They are free of the silly conventions of all other sects, more like Unitarians. Met Miss Foote and her beau coming out of the theater on my way back to the ship. Asked her on board for tea. With her came all the local gossip. Monday went ashore again and got loads of mail. 3 letters from Sister Nettie about her lost romance. She wants to get a loan to come east and take her master's degree at Columbia and then continue dedicating her life to teaching. Poor misguided dear. 3 delayed Christmas packages. 1 card from Captain J.W., Captain Will, saying he arrove in Martinique. He probably gets arrove from arrive, because a heaving line, once heaved, is hove. Or is it because a driven oxen is drove? Anyhow, I love the old English he acquired from his mother, she of the be ye from here or be ye from away. He was delayed on his trip to sunny Martinique by having been caught in the ice in Upper Chesapeake Bay for 3 long, gloomy, cold weeks. Poor dear, how he must have raged, cursed, and threatened. February 15th, 1912. Pump broke down again and holds flooded, so could load no cargo. The lumber would get soaked, swell up, and bend. Started loading in the afternoon. Went on 2 auto rides in the same day, the first with the ship's agent down to the oyster country on the eastern shore, where Fred ate buckets, not just dozens, of enormous, luscious oysters, and I modestly confined myself to quartz. If it's true about what people say oysters do to sexual proclivities, God help us tonight. Miss Foote stayed all night, apparently sent by God, for Fred stayed primly away from me to avoid any noise that might betray his animal lusts when approaching me in bed, as I felt the oysters or do I imagine it? I finally told him to chuck his modesty and come to bed. He was so surprised that he was absolutely kind and gentle. Of course, I took advantage of that to declare in soft, sweet words that anything approaching an abortion was beyond the wildest possibility. True to his character, either the commander or the little boy, he acquiesced. Not only another trick to Dora, but also the whole blooming game. Miss Foote likes the two Rio waists I purchased for her, and gave me a check for them. Fred, with his usual perverted Downey's sense of humor, let the check fall to the deck and, upon being asked by the dumbfounded Miss Foote what for, said he wanted to see if it bounced. She brought us a primrose, and it's such a dear, sweet, lovely little flower. I told Fred he was being boorish, and I could see from his puzzled face that he thought I meant something to do with sex, he thinking of a boor in a pig's way, the poor illiterate dear. I must read to him more, like I shall do for my baby. Soon I shall have two babies on my hand. February 29th, 1912, leap year. Uptown, where purchased Norman Duncan's Measure of a Man and George Meredith's Diana of the Crossways. Went to a moving picture show, and can't say I think much of them in comparison to opera or vaudeville. The Orpheum, last Thursday, had a wonderful quartet, and I enjoyed the acrobatic tumbling. Fred did, too, until I made a stupid remark about bedtime acrobatics. Metti la patta. Editor's note. I put my foot in my mouth. Went as Miss Foote's guest to the Duval Theatre, where saw Every Woman, and it was a good, perfectly splendid stage drama, with a message so profound that it stayed with me and strengthened me better than a sermon might. That's all we have time for in this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, The Diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son James. I'm Cynthia Bowman. Thank you for listening.